Tour Junkies.
What's up, golf addicts? Thank you for downloading the Tour Junkies podcast. This episode is an interview with our friend Jason Sobel. Jason is a senior contributor on ESPN and ESPN.com. Been covering golf for nearly 20 years. He's got some great stories that he shares with us, including a great Phil Mickelson gambling story. We talk about the state of golf media. We talk about DFS and how it's perceived both from the player and from the media, and maybe the future of DFS as it pertains to the PGA Tour. We've got some laughs in this episode. It's a great one. We enjoyed our conversation with Jason. We know you will too. This episode is brought to you by Swing Caddy. Listen, we've been pumping the Swing Caddy for a couple months now. We have one ourselves. We love it. If you don't want to spend the thousands of dollars on a TrackMan, but you want to see some numbers on your golf swing, your swing speed, your ball speed, your carry distance, the Swing Caddy can help you do that. And all you got to do is go to tourjunkies.com, and at the top of our page, you can click Swing Caddy promo. And when you go to check out, make sure you put in Tour Junkies, all lowercase, all one word, in the promo box. Click apply, and you can save $60 off the Swing Caddy and get it for less than $300. It's a pretty good deal. A great device if you're trying to improve your real golf game. So thanks again for downloading this episode of the Tour Junkies podcast. We hope you enjoy. May your screens be green. See ya. What's going on, golf addicts? The Tour Junkies podcast. We have got a fresh one for you, a brand new guest. We kind of teased this guest on Twitter a little bit today. We're excited about this one. We like bringing something fresh, a fresh perspective to the Tour Junkies podcast and to the PGA Tour in general. We have got Jason Sobel, senior golf writer from ESPN.com, Sports Emmy winner, esteemed and decorated by the Golf Writers Association of America, New York native, co-host of the ESPN Golf Podcast with his wacky sidekick, Michael Collins. He's been covering golf since like 2000, and he's just inside the ropes week in and week out and just loves golf, knows golf. We're glad to have Jason on the show. What's up, Jason? How are you, man?
What's up, fellas? First of all, thanks for the nice introduction. Secondly, how long have we been talking about this? I mean, we've been talking for, what, 2 years? About, like, hey, let's find a date.
It's been too long.
Like, finally, we had to go, okay, like, how about Wednesday night at 9? Yeah, okay, that's the only time we can all get together. Perfect. Okay, after 2 years, we finally figured out a time when we can all do this. So, glad we could finally make this happen.
Now, you're being nice because, you know, Jason, we're about 3 weeks away from the two-year anniversary of Tour Junkies' first ever podcast. And had we asked you 2 years ago, I'm pretty sure you would have said no because you had no idea who we were.
You know what?
Somehow we managed to pop up on your Twitter feed.
I wouldn't say that. You know, I'm not one of the nicest guys out there. I'm not like, you know, I don't profess to be like, wow, you know, I love helping people out. I love doing stuff. If you had called me and said, hey, look, we're starting up this podcast. We want you on. I'd say, you know what? I got nothing better to do. Why not? Yeah, absolutely. I'll
there
do
you
it.
Go.
So I don't say no to much. So, but yes, absolutely. Do you guys almost on your 2 year mark? Absolutely.
Almost.
Anytime. Especially when yeah, well, on Wednesday night.
There we go. We could make this a regular thing. You know, you ditch that Michael Collins guy and you just come hang out with us every week. You probably, you'd have some fun.
Michael who?
Yeah, I know, right? well, let's get started. We just want to have a casual conversation with you, man. You've been around golf and the PGA Tour, you know, for a while. You've seen a lot of what ourselves and our listeners, I think, are really interested in, and just kind of life on tour and inside the ropes. But, you know, first of all, we thought you might kind of give us a little bit of background on yourself and like your initial entry into the golf media world and what's going on for you now and just like catch us up real quick.
There is, like, no sort of, I guess, how do I put it, sort of normal path to get into golf writing. I don't know that there's, like, just one thing, oh, well, I went to school for it, and then I got a job, and then I kept working, and that's what I did. It just doesn't really exist. So, I mean, I worked my butt off in college, which had nothing to do with college, but I wrote for magazines, wrote for newspapers, Worked at the sports radio station up in Boston. I did a lot of stuff like that in college. Wound up getting a job at ESPN just about 3 weeks after college graduation. I went to Brandeis University up in Waltham, Massachusetts. And so I started ESPN as a production assistant, entry level, producing highlights, working late nights and 6 days a week and holidays and weekends and all that good stuff. And after a few years, I graduated to associate producer and eventually graduated to highlight supervisor. And after a couple of years of being a highlight supervisor, I got wind of the golf editor job open for ESPN.com. And I didn't know exactly what it was, but I had a writing background. I had a video background, obviously, from working in TV, which they were just starting to integrate more video onto the website at that point. And I had a golf background. I'd covered a handful of U.S. Opens for the TV side. And for whatever reason, somebody at ESPN.com thought those things all worked together pretty well, and so I got the job. And so at that time, I get the job. I said, wow, this is great. And we didn't have a writer. We had Bob Harrod, who wrote for the St. Pete Times, obviously writes for us now, but he would write like one or two things a week for us. And every once in a while, for majors, we'd send columnists, but we didn't have a full-time staff golf writer. And so my first day on the job, I'm sitting there, and I said, you know, we don't have any content. I went to my boss, and I said, can I write something? And my boss said, yeah, I don't care. Go ahead. I mean, really, like, he did not care. So I went, and I wrote something, and I posted it to the website, and no one seemed to yell at me for anything. The next day, I went to him. I said, Willis, we have no content again. Can I write something else? He goes, yeah, I don't care. And so I went, and I wrote something else, and pretty soon, I was basically the editor and writer of the section, and I did that for about 4 years where I was kind of doing two jobs simultaneously, and finally they just said, look, either they said you're a better writer or editor than an editor, or you cause less damage as a writer than an editor. But either way, they just put me on staff as a senior writer. So I've been doing that ever since. I left for 4 years, went to Golf Channel, moved down to Orlando where I still live, went back to ESPN about 2.5 years ago, and I'm thrilled there. It's a really good place, really good people to work with, and I couldn't be happier about the situation. I go out and cover golf. Like any job, I can complain about things. Everyone can complain about any job. I try to catch myself from complaining too much about it because it really is a pretty damn cool job. I'm on the road about, 22, 24 weeks out of the year covering PGA Tour golf and walking around some of the best fairways in the world and talking to some of the best golfers in the world. So it is pretty cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely, you know, as we learn from a lot of players and caddies too that we have on the podcast, you know, it's not. There are some downsides to it. It does seem like it's just the best thing in the world, but it's a lot of travel. It's a lot of, a lot of moving parts. So I'm sure that there are some parts of your job that aren't so sexy, but I think there's a lot of parts that a lot of our listeners would love to, would love to have. So it's cool and it seems like, I mean, you took some initiative there. So you've obviously been like a golf fan for a while, right? Like did you get into golf at a young age?
I will tell you my story. So I do remember watching some tournaments as a kid with my grandfather, who was a big time golfer and loved the game, but really didn't get into it until basically my grandfather died when I was 18, my freshman year of college. And I went to his funeral and afterwards I was at his house and I turned to my grandmother and I said, can I have his golf clubs? And she said, yeah, of course. We're not going to do anything with them. So I took his golf clubs. That was my first real set of clubs was when I was 18. I didn't grow up playing that much, grew up playing every other sport and loving every other sport. But then I got the bug a little bit. I was a camp counselor, the summer of my sophomore year. And I'm going somewhere with this and it's a pretty good story. So hang with me. It takes a second. But when I was a camp counselor between my sophomore and junior years of college, I would get out of camp at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Me and a couple of buddies would go to this par 3 course called Robert Moses on Long Island, 100-yard holes, if that. You bring a wedge, you bring a putter, and unbeknownst to me, I was just out there having fun. But it's actually a great way to learn the game. I mean, go out there and hit nothing but wedges and putts and figure out the short game, and then you can work on the driver later. So I kind of learned how to play a little bit, and week before I went back to school for my junior year, I called up one of my best friends, Matt Mitchell, who's the captain of the golf team at Brandeis, the now defunct Brandeis University golf team. And I said, look, I've started playing golf a little bit. I'm not good. Can I kind of be on the team or at least practice with the team, be around the team? And he said, well, I'll introduce you to coach. and we'll see what he has to say. So I get back to school, first day back. He brings me down to the gym. Coach is this guy named Bob Branham, who was a power forward for the Celtics back in the 50s. And you talk about a guy with hands like meat hooks. He had meat hooks. I mean, his hand could just envelop your hand. Grumpy, old, gruff guy. We used to be in his office, and he'd answer the phone, and go, "What do you want? Stop fucking calling me." And he'd hang up the phone. And we're like, "Who is that?" He goes, "Ah, it was fucking Cousy again." We're like, you can't talk to Bob Cousy like that. In any case, that was Coach Branham. So we go down to the gym. I hit about 10 balls into a net in the gym. And he turns to me and he says, "Well, you're not very good." I said, "Yeah, I know. Just learning." And he said, "Well, can you drive?" And I go to take out my driver. I'm thinking, you know, he's going to give me some lesson, you know, whatever. I said, "He goes, not that. Hey, can you drive a car?" I said, "Yeah, of course I can." And now I'm thinking, like, you know, he's going to say, "It's just like driving a car. You have to do this in order to learn the golf." So I said, "Yeah." He said, "Do you have a car here on campus?" I said, "I do, actually." He said, "Does it have a trunk?" I'm like, "What is he getting at?" I'm like, "Yeah, it has a trunk." He goes, "How many people can fit in it?" I don't know, 5? He goes, "Can you drive to practice?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "All right, you're on the team." And so I was a college golfer because I had a car at college.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Congratulations. What a, you know, I missed that part in the research. I should have thrown that in the introduction that esteemed college career because you had a trunk.
The postscript to that story is we got through about 3 months of the season. It was, I think, the last tournament of the year. And we're talking about the New England Invitational, where it's not just Division III schools. We were non-scholarship, and even the kids that played on the team were good golfers for college players, but certainly not Division I level, certainly not anybody that's going to go professional at any point. And so, unbeknownst to me, we get to this tournament at the end of the year, and we had a big party in my apartment on a Friday night at 7 a.m. on Saturday morning. The phone starts ringing, and it's one of those, you know, so you sit up and you feel like your head is ringing. You're like, "Oh, it's the phone." Answer the phone. Guy on the team says, "Look, 3 guys have midterms. 2 guys are sick. I even called my brother. He doesn't even go to school here. We can't field the team unless you can make it." And I go, "Yeah, sure, man, I'll play." Literally, it might have been my first full round of 18 holes playing golf on a real course at New Seabury on Cape Cod, which I've since been back to. Andy Bissett, who's the CFO of Travelers and sort of runs the Travelers Championship, is a member there. After I told him the story, he took me back out a couple of years ago, and I at least felt a little better about myself, that I've gotten better over the last 20 years. But so I went and played in this tournament against kids who, I mean, the parents were random. I was playing with kids who were on scholarship Division I schools in New England, and I am sitting there just popping the ball all over the place. It was as embarrassing as it ever could be.
That's horrible. Yeah, that's basically what me and Pat do every time we play golf.
yeah, exactly.
Not true, just Pat. Hey, going back to your time at the Golf Channel, did you ever have an experience where you came to blows with Brandel Chamblee?
I'm going to tell you, I'm being completely honest, because I would, you know, I'll tell you.
No, I believe you. We're going to believe you.
Get along. He's one of my favorite people in golf. I am being dead honest with you. Not only is he one of my favorite people, I think he's one of the smartest people in the game. I have been around him. I've worked on shows with him. I've been around him when he's preparing for those shows. I'm not sure there's anybody who works harder. He's got iPads filled with swings of players. He can go back and look at Ricky Fowler's swing in 2009 and Ricky Fowler's swing last week and say, here's what he's doing a little bit differently, and figure out why he's doing this and why it's better for him. He's got notes from everywhere. He's got every possible stat, and he's got he's well spoken about it too. I understand that a lot of times people can watch him and disagree with him, and what always flummoxes me is the fact that people can't separate the fact that they disagree with him but still think he's intelligent and informative. And I really like that in a person. I listen to Colin Cowherd a lot, both when he was on ESPN.
Yeah.
Now he's working for Fox. I listen to Colin Cowherd, and half the time, maybe more than half the time, I go, he is out of his mind nuts. I don't agree with him, but he's intelligently putting together a coherent, cogent point that I go, well, I don't agree with it, but I respect his opinion. He's at least making me think of it. And the fact that people can't see that about Brandel, that look, you might not agree with what he's saying, but you can at least look at it from his perspective and say, I get where he's going with it, though, and he's really smart about what he's saying. So, I really like Brad. I'd tell you if I ever came to blows with it, he's one of my favorite people, seriously. I'll give you, here's another great sort of example to another guy who's an ESPN guy for a long time and now is with Fox, but I used to, as a production assistant, we were talking about my old days, beginning with ESPN as a production assistant. One of my jobs, I believe about 2 years in, was working on some NFL shows. And every Monday morning, I'd get in early during the football season, 7 a.m. I'd collect up. Back then, they were all on beta tape. All the games would be taped. There'd be two beta copies, and those were like gold to have kind of in your bin throughout the day and not give up to anybody, because like literally the entire company has two copies of the Packers-Vikings game from the day before, and I would try to collect one just for our show. And so one day, I go down to the, we had a videotape library, I go down there, and there's nothing else in there. And none of the games are there from the day before. And I'm, you know, I get checked out by this guy. Who is this guy? I go down to the screening room, and Mark Schlereth, on his first day of work, had gotten there at 6 a.m., taken all the tapes, and he was going through them just as he had gone through game film when he was a player. And I told Sink that a couple of years ago. I said, look, I've always remembered that about you, and I think that that's the difference between being a good analyst and a great analyst, is going that extra mile, and I think that's the same thing that Brandle does as well.
Well, all right, so yeah, Brandle is somewhat controversial, so let's switch gears a little bit and talk about your article that you came out with, I guess it was last week, about players and tour players and sort of this culture of them being friends and pulling for each other and things like that. You know, kind of talk a little bit about your article and then your thoughts there. And then, you know, because I'm with you. I think that players, you know, it's just, you can't look at it like you do football teams or basketball teams or whatever. I mean, these guys, they are rooting for each other, but they want to beat each other's brains out. And I think it makes the game better. So I guess just kind of give us your thoughts about your article and just kind of on that situation.
Well, first of all, I mean, it's occurred to me for the last few years, and I hear it anytime Ricky and Justin are waiting on the final green for Jordan, or Jordan and Ricky with Bud Cauley on the final green for Justin. You hear it on Twitter. All these people go, they should be almost like they should be like on the range working on their games for next time, or they should be in the locker room sulking about how they didn't win this week. They shouldn't be happy for another competitor. And it's like, I think Zach Johnson said it best. He said, look, we're all playing against the golf course. I can't play defense against another guy. There's nothing I could have done better to stop him. It's not like I could have defended him on the ball better and blocked his shot like in a basketball game. So you might as well just be happy for a guy and congratulate a guy. And you can say it's pretty good karma for these guys as well, because, you know, I talked to Jordan, hey, did you think you would jinx it when you drank out of the claret jug when Zach won? He goes, nope, never even crossed my mind. Guess what? 2 years later, he goes and wins. Justin drinks out of his claret jug. A month later, he's winning the Wanamaker trophy. So I really respect the fact that these guys can put it aside. They can put their own efforts aside, at least for a little while, and say, man, I want to go congratulate a buddy who I'm really good friends with, I'm really happy for. And I thought it was important in that piece to show that it's not just these millennial guys who maybe get paid too much money these days and don't care enough about winning, which is why I went back and I spoke with Gary Player and Jack Nicklaus, actually traded emails with each of them and their representatives. And I got in some really good stories from both Player and Nicklaus back in the day, basically saying we did the same thing. We might not have been standing on the 18th green, but we might have waited in the locker room or waited in the parking lot or gone out for beers afterwards. And we were around our friends when they won and we congratulated them. So I really thought it was important to show that this is nothing new. It's not like in the last 2 years guys started congratulating each other after victories. This has been going on for over a half century, and quite frankly, maybe even a lot longer than that. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with it, and I certainly hope these guys keep doing it. In fact, I was in the middle of asking Jordan a question the other day in the flash interview area as Justin had finished up on 18 at TPC Boston, and Jordan said, Jason, hold on 1 second. Let me go do this. And he jumped off the podium, ran up to Justin, gave him a little bro hug, said congratulations, and then came and ran back out on the podium and said, sorry, I just had to do that real quick, which I thought was really cool. And I will say this much, and, you know, I kind of got into this conversation in a radio interview the other day, that the game needs as many personalities as it can get. It needs polarizing figures. And what I mean by that is we need more players who you root for and root against, more players who inspire passion. I've always thought this way, that Bubba Watson isn't necessarily a favorite of a lot of people. And that's okay. In fact, it's actually great for the game to have guys who are up on the leaderboard and people go, man, I'm going to watch just because I don't want that guy to win. Now, yeah. Does Bubba want people to root against him? Probably not. I'm sure he wants people to like him, but that's okay. Ian Poulter, people at TPC Boston this past week were openly rooting against him and yelling at him while he was playing every week in the United States when he's playing out here. I don't know if that's great for Ian Poulter. I don't know if that's great for his mindset, but I think it's good for the game to have players that you don't just shrug your shoulders at and go, eh, seems like a nice guy. I guess I like him. You either really like guys or you dislike players. And the players that inspire passion, the more of those players we can get in the game, I think it's a better thing for the game overall.
So, all right, so talking about good for the game, you know, David and I obviously talk a lot of fantasy golf, drafting, mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, daily fantasy. You know, what do you think, what's the impact, you know, you think fantasy golf has on tour as far as popularity, you know, TV ratings, engagement? I mean, we obviously have a way that we think about it because we think it's very good for the tour. And you know, you get new people involved in the game that never would have been. So just give us your thoughts on that and kind of how you think that direction is going as far as the tour itself is concerned.
I've never been one of these sort of gloom and doom scenario type guys when it comes to the future of the game. I think people tend to look at golf without Tiger Woods in this post-Tiger era and say, oh, golf is doomed and golf is never going to be good again and no one's going to watch, the numbers are down. I think that you have to take it for what it was. It's always been a niche sport. It took a huge spike when Tiger was in his prime. Tiger isn't playing anymore, or at least he's not playing right now. And so those numbers have dipped a little bit, and you know, they basically regressed to the mean. And that's okay. That's what they're supposed to do. That said, any new faces, especially younger faces, that we can bring to the game is obviously good. I mean, you can't have enough of that. In fact, I think DFS content, whether it's fantasy, daily fantasy, whether you're straight gambling on players, it's all good. I think that if it gets you interested in the game, I think it's a benefit for the tour. It's a benefit for the game in general. I've had this idea for at least 12, maybe 14 years. And this dates back to the days when basically Tiger would play an event and 90% of the crowd at that event would be following Tiger. And then in the other way, Phil would be playing and at least 50% would be following Phil. My idea was that every fan walks through the gate with their ticket and they get handed, it's a little slip of paper. It's like a Cracker Jack prize. You rip it open, it's got a player's name on it. If that player has the low score of the day, you win something. I don't know. It doesn't matter. It can be something from the sponsor, be something from an auxiliary sponsor. Maybe it's an ice cream cone. Maybe it's a raffle ticket to win a car. It doesn't even matter what it is. But you rip that thing open, and you look at it, and it says Scott Verplank. Guess what you're going to do? You're going to run to the fourth hole where Scott Verplank is, and you're going to root like hell for him to go out and shoot the best round of the day. And if he does it, you're going to remember him for the next 30 years as the guy who won you an ice cream cone. And at least it gets you rooting for other players. And I think that's what DFS, fantasy, gambling, all those things do it. It gets you learning more about players. It gets you personally involved with the players, personally invested in what they're doing. I think it's a huge benefit for the game.
Jason, you're a sharp guy, and I know you know a little bit about fantasy golf and DFS and that kind of thing as well. Do you think, and you've been covering this since the, you know, 2000, so do you think that we are more likely to see, if DFS, let's talk specifically for a minute DFS, not the that sorry Avis fantasy game that the PGA Tour pumps on their website. But let's talk specifically DFS. If it were legalized, let's say in the state of Florida and or just federally, if it were legalized, do you think we are, with Jay Monahan being the commissioner, are we in a better spot to see the tour embrace it than we were with Tim Fincham before him?
Absolutely. I think that there's no question that Jay is younger. He's sort of hipper, to use a non-young term, but he's more kind of with it. He understands newer things, and he understands change a little bit better, embraces change. So I certainly think it's in better hands with Jay. In fact, I think golf in general, you look from Jay Monahan to Keith Pelley of the European Tour to Pete Bavakwa, there are a lot of really smart sort of younger people who are in charge of the game these days, and I think that's put the game in really good hands moving forward. The other thing that really helps is you look at some of the other commissioners, maybe not Roger Goodell, but I know Adam Silver has really embraced the idea that, hey, gambling's okay, and maybe we should legalize this, and maybe we tax it, and maybe we turn this into something where it's not sort of thought of in back alleys and only Las Vegas, where there's something where we can do some good from it. Maybe money goes to charity, whatever it might be. And I think that once one of those sports fully embraces it, the other ones will come around as well and see that there's an added benefit to it as well. So I don't know how much Jay Monahan knows about DFS. I don't know how much he even right now cares about DFS. I'm sure he's got a lot of other priorities on his plate before that. But if and when the time comes up that it's brought to his table and said, look, we kind of want you to make a decision. Are you in or out on this? What do you think? And if it's completely legal nationwide, boy, I think it's something that he thinks seriously about and says, look, if this brings more people to the game, if this brings more fans to the PGA Tour events, more people watching, I'm all for it.
Do you think the players, like, overall, what do you think the sentiment or the awareness level of PGA Tour players is around DFS and fantasy sports?
Even the ones who don't quite understand it are very aware of it. They're very aware, especially guys on social media, are aware when, you know, they shoot 76 and guys go on social media and say, you're a bum, you screwed me today. They get to say, they might not understand, like, hey, he has a lineup and he has to spend X amount of dollars in his lineup, and so he fit me in under the salary cap as one of his guys or eight guys. They might not understand the full concept, but they know, hey, they're invested in me this week and I didn't play well. That means they're not going to make their money, and so they're mad at me. They get that. That's a pretty easy concept to grasp. Now, other ones who are more savvy, and look, there are a lot of guys on tour, they won't admit it. They like their action. I was out on the fight with a couple of tour players, the Mayweather fight a few weeks ago, and one of them's looking at the over on the Stanford Rice second half score and going, you know, he started looking at stuff, and he goes, you know, I've wanted to do that golf FanDuel stuff for a long time. He's just like, it just feels a little kind of weird to me. I just feel like I shouldn't do it. I think I'd clean up on it if I did it. And I go, yeah, you probably shouldn't do that. For a guy who's making a few $1 million a year in earnings,
right,
probably not much benefit to coming out there and trying to do that. And, you know, maybe, what if he wins $1 million playing FanDuel didn't have himself that week? It's just a really bad look. But I think they understand it. At least they're savvy enough to get it.
Yeah, it's probably got a little Pete Rose feel to it. Well, you bring up a good point. Like, we always, anytime we have a player on, we typically ask them, you know, are you aware of DraftKings, or do you feel like it's something that you're more aware of now than you used to be? And they all have said yes. You know, they hear people yelling at them on the course, hey, man, do good this week, I got you on my fantasy team, blah, blah, blah. But very recently we had, and this has been going on since DraftKings, especially in 2015, but you mentioned kind of the troll on Twitter and, you know, the stupid fantasy golf fan that wants to at a tour pro for having a bad week or withdrawing or whatever, since day one of the Tour Junkies podcast, we have done nothing but admonish that behavior. That is ridiculous and stupid, and there's a whole lot of things we said about it in our last episode, but you had the Graham Dillette thing. You know, clearly a guy who... So some of the people that do what we do on Twitter that you may or may not know of are saying things like, you know, man, Graham is missing an opportunity to market himself. Graham's missing an opportunity to touch base with a fan base, you know, here and kind of criticizing him there. I mean, you know, so I guess the thing is, like, it's easy for Pat and I, especially in our Tour Junkies bubble, to feel like the DFS influence is bigger than it probably is.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is like, how much influence do you think the DFS community in golf has on things like paying for PGA Tour Live and watching featured groups when coverage is nowhere? Things like, you know, the millennial TV ratings on the Golf Channel in the last 2 years. Things like, you know, paying attention to the Shell Houston Open or, you know, whatever other random, the Wyndham.
Sure.
How much do you actually think, what's your opinion on the actual influence of the DFS community on things like that?
It's a great question. I couldn't even guess at that. Just because, I mean, there's got to be a number you can put on it. I'm not sure if there's been a study. I honestly don't know if it's, you know, 5% more or 20% more. I just don't know the answer. What I would say is that I would be willing to bet that the average age of viewer for the Shell Houston Open 5 years ago on a Thursday afternoon might have been, 59, and these days might be 54, because the younger viewers who are playing DFS and playing fantasy golf are now tuning in, and so it's brought a younger demographic into the game. So I'd be willing to bet that that's the case. As far as like the exact influence, I don't know. I do want to get into, and I'm taking a little bit of a left turn here, but sort of related to everything.
Feel free.
I wrote a DFS column for about a year and a half for ESPN, and one of the things that people really didn't like about it was the fact that it was behind a paywall, and quite frankly, I agree with them, and it's one of the reasons I stopped doing it, because you shouldn't necessarily have to pay for that content if all of my other content is going to be free out there, and you can read every other story I write, but if you want to win your FanDuel or DraftKings tournament that week, you've got to pay for it. So I didn't necessarily like that either, and I got a lot of criticism for that. But the second thing was that people would sort of yell at me for, hey, you're just a golf writer. You don't know anything about DFS, as if I could understand the concept of it. You guys know, I've told you before, I play very limited golf. I just kind of like talking about that player before. It feels a little icky to me. I'll make a couple of lineups every week for very low stakes, just to kind of see like ownership levels and just kind of see like what people are doing, who people are picking, and what people think that week. But for the most part, I don't get too into golf, but I do baseball every single night. Hockey season, I absolutely love. I can't believe they don't have college football anymore, because that was my absolute favorite.
Yeah.
I'll do NFL along with the entire rest of the world too. And I like it. It gives you more reason to watch. You know, people talk about watching TV shows at night. Hey, do you watch this show? Do you watch that show?
Nope.
I throw in a few FanDuel lineups, and then I watch baseball games every night, and that's more enjoyable to me than anything else I could watch on TV, and it definitely enhances the experience. But I will say, I got criticism a couple times back in the day. I think it was probably 2 or 3 years ago, I had picked Webb Simpson to win at the Greenbrier, and Wednesday evening, I see Webb in the lobby of the hotel, and he's sort of like working on his swing. He's like doing like this air golf swing in the lobby of the hotel at the Greenbrier. And I go up to him. I know Webb pretty well. I go up to him and I give him a little crap. And I say, you're working on your swing on Wednesday night? And Webb turns to me and goes, no, dude, like an hour ago, I just lifted my kid out of the pool and like my rib totally like locked up on me. And I don't even know if I can play tomorrow. And I said, oh my God. So I walked away, and it was very sort of gray area where I wasn't sitting there with a recorder and a notebook saying, hey, Webb, how are you feeling today? What's going on? But I also knew some information that could change a pick that a lot of people, I may have influenced people to make. And now I understand that there's different information out there. So I basically went on Twitter and said, look, as a guy who knows some things that other people might not know, you might want to stay off my Webb Simpson pick for this week. And people were so mad at me because they go, look, what are you trying to do? People accuse me of trying to drive down ownership levels so that my teams could win with Webb Simpson. People accuse me of not reporting a story. I had people accusing me. They said, I said, look, I can't report it because, it's sort of off the record, but I do know some information. And people said, look, there's no reporting in DFS. And I said, there's reporting in everything. And this is one of the things I know, you guys and I were texting and DMing the other day about, sort of what we could talk about on the pod. I think that there's definitely a space that's available where you guys have what you do, we do what we do. And I mean, I know certain things where, even if I can't necessarily go out and say it, I know reasons why a player will play well or why he won't play well. Hey, so-and-so always plays well when his wife is staying at home and she's not at the tournament with him and she's not here this week. Now, that's not going to show up in any kind of stats page that you're working on. It's not going to show up in any kind of algorithm, but that's pretty good. Nah. There's one player who, anytime he would travel to a city, young single player, anytime he would travel to a city where there are a lot of young ladies in that city, Phoenix, he wouldn't play well that week. Guess why? And so, you know, of course, I can't go in an article and say that on the record about a player without him actually telling me that and having sourced information. But it was kind of one of these things within PGA Tour circles. Everybody knew, hey, don't take him at Phoenix, but Hartford, Connecticut might be a nice place to take him that week.
Well, you know, I can tell you, Jason, from just the 2 years that David and I have done this, you learn to grow some pretty thick skin when it comes to making picks and and things like that, because we certainly take a decent amount of flack, but it's okay. You know, we understand that. But, you know, you bring up kind of a good point, because, you know, you have sort of what we would say, I don't want to say DFS media, because I wouldn't really consider us media, but we're, you know, we're talking about golf and doing that kind of thing, just like you are. We're writing articles, things like that. So, you know, you're on more of the traditional side, the ESPN side, that kind of thing. You know, so how does just traditional media think of the DFS media? Do you think there's we can mesh together going, you know, in what we do going forward? And how do you think that, how are we accepted, I guess, is what I want to say, as far as the media is concerned?
It's a good question. I think I'm a little separated from some of the more traditional media guys. I'll be sitting there making hockey lineups while I'm covering, you know, Torrey Pines. and guys are looking at me like, why are you making hot? What are you doing? And like, they don't quite get it. But I think we're still a little bit ways away from, like, kind of everyone sort of integrating a little bit more and understanding that that's part of it. But I certainly think that it could be and should be going forward. I mean, let's say you guys had the wherewithal to go out on tour and cover, let's say, the same schedule as me, about 24 events a year or so. And you go out there and you find out fantasy golf information. And you're looking for stuff, whether it's, you know, I actually think there's probably a big market for it. Whereas instead of just looking at stats and numbers, you're actually talking to players and finding out, hey, this guy loves the course. He's swinging it really well on Tuesday afternoon. Watch out this week. Or, hey, look, this guy just doesn't have it. I think it's very beneficial. There's one player who I've become very close with, and I'll walk with him. If I'm not too busy on a Tuesday for a practice round or a Wednesday pro-am round, I'm going to walk a few holes with him, just kind of catch up and say hi. And I can walk with him, and after three or four holes, I know if he's going to play well or not that week. And I can absolutely tell. And so if I was completely devoted to only DFS and only fantasy, I could find that out about a lot of players. I'll give you a really good story. This is actually one of my favorite stories about covering the tour. This was, about 10 years ago, maybe more. You can probably look up the date based on the story that I give you. But there was a guy we called Harry the Hack. He was an English guy named Harry Emanuel, who wrote for an online betting website. Got paid about £100 a week, but would come to America and cover tournaments. And basically, he would fund his own way covering the tournaments because he wasn't getting paid much, but he could get a credential because he was writing. And so he would come out with his credential and go talk to players and say, hey, how you feeling? You know, you like this course? How's your swing? I mean, all the usual questions that any other writer would ask, but he's asking for the gambler's advantage on it. And so we're out at Kapalua 1 year, and we've been hanging out all week. It's Wednesday afternoon. I haven't seen him all day. Finally, walks into the media center at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, just covered in sweat. He's puffing and puffing. You know, what have you been doing? Where were you? He goes, I was just figuring out who's going to win. What are you talking about? He goes, oh, I just walked the entire back nine with Daniel Chopra. He's playing great. You know, Daniel Chopra is not winning at Kapalua. You've got, at the time, I mean, I don't know who exactly was there, but Ernie Els, and you've got Adam Scott, and you've got all these great players here. Daniel Chopra only got in because he won at Disney in a deal that wasn't great right at the end of the year before. He's not going to, he goes, he's been playing his Xbox, been playing Kapalua on Tiger Woods game nonstop for the last few weeks. He loves the course. He's been practicing, and most of the guys go to Kapalua and treat it as a vacation. He's been really working at it, and so he backed Daniel Chopra, put a lot of money on him. Guess what? Daniel Chopra won that week. You go back and look, it was probably 06, 07. He won at Kapalua that week, and my buddy nailed it just by walking nine holes with him on Wednesday.
That's nuts. That is nuts.
And I'm not sure, you know, based on the fact that, look, media has changed, and it's no longer just traditional media. When I started, I would say three-quarters of the press room on any given week were newspaper writers. Now, you're lucky if you find, outside of the local writers for that week, you're lucky if you find two newspaper writers at a given PGA Tour stop, and there's a lot more digital media, so I don't see why the continued evolution of that wouldn't include DFS writers as well. And you've got guys going out there specifically to find out how players are feeling, who likes the course, who's dealing with a little bit of an injury, who feels really good. If you can help people and be a benefit to people by doing that, I'm not sure why you wouldn't do that.
Sounds good to me, Jason. We just need you to be commissioner, man. That's all. I do want to know, so you told a couple good stories. We can jump off of the DFS thing, but we did want to know if you had, we're right here in Augusta. Pat and I both grew up in Augusta, going to the Masters since we were kids. We did want to know if you had any really good Augusta National stories from your time covering the Masters. Now, your boy Michael Collins was on our show last fall, and he told a story that I'll never forget, and I've retold the story to a lot of people. About the media room one year when I guess there were some Wi-Fi issues and you guys went in there to type your articles and do your columns and the internet wasn't working. So everybody went home and the next morning he tells a story. Yeah. Was that 2006?
Yeah.
So it's like the next morning everybody had Ethernet to their cubicle, which is just nuts.
Totally true.
But, you know, having been out there our whole lives, I was a caddy there for 2 years. There's just these things that Augusta National does that people just don't understand. They have the power to do. It's mind blowing. So I didn't know if you had a different story you could share with us, or just something cool that happened at Augusta.
Man, I'm trying to think. You guys might know this story. This is outside of the Masters. This is just sort of an Augusta National story. You guys might know the story and might know it better than me, and I might even tell it wrong, and you're going to correct me on it. But the way the legend goes, at least, there was a caddy out there who was caddying for Bill Gates, who's a member. And they're out on the 16th hole. And I could have the caddy, I could have all sorts of details wrong with this, but this is how it's been passed down over the last 10 years to me. So Bill Gates on the 16th hole, and he goes to the caddy and says, "Give me my 8-iron. And the caddy says, "Well, you know, Mr. Gates, I really think it's a 7 today." "But no, I always hit 8 here." "But, well, I think it should be 7. "Well, no, I always hit 8. And the caddy goes, "Sir, it's 7-iron. Fine. Begrudgingly takes the 7-iron from him. Of course, knocks it right in the hole for a hole-in-1. This guy's thinking, heyday. I am getting paid big time. The richest man in the world just made a hole-in-1 because of my club selection. I am going to make big time money off of this." And so the round ends and Bill Gates kind of disappears and the guy never gets paid. And so for the next, however long, week, months, even, the guy is walking around just grumbling about, "Man, I helped Bill Gates make a hole in one and I didn't get anything from it. This is ridiculous." Turns out they've been talking early in the round and the guy had a young daughter, I believe. And again, details are very fuzzy from the stories have been passed down, but I believe the guy had a young daughter, the caddy. He'd been telling Bill Gates about her. And as it turns out, Bill Gates went and paid for the girl's college education as a tip for the caddy that day.
Amazing. Yeah, we have. I've heard that story. Pat, have you heard that story?
I actually have not heard that story. That's awesome. Pretty cool. Well,
so what was the first year you covered out there, Jason?
First one I did was 2005, which was a decent one. Some guy named Tiger won that year.
Yep. I was sitting on 18 green that Sunday when that went down. That's pretty cool.
You've been sitting on 16 green.
Yeah, I know. Well, I was sitting on 18, and we heard this roar. I'll never forget that. I mean, I was sitting there watching the score, you know, watching the scoreboard, and we heard this roar, and you just knew. I mean, I've been out there my whole life. I'm like, that's the hole-in-one Tiger roar. That's not a birdie roar. That's not a roar for somebody else. It's not even a hole-in-one roar for who he was playing with, for DeMarco or whoever it was. That's a hole-in-one Tiger roar. And then they put the birdie up there, and we're like, what? Like, who's the roar for? You know, why? You just don't know, because you know you're unplugged from the rest of the world until you go home.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
and then I
stay for the playoff with DeMarco, and I go home, and I'm finding out what in the world that roar was about. It was the chip on 16. It was nuts. That was the loudest roar I've ever heard at the Masters in my entire life.
Quick segue off of that. I would love to sit, like, and I think you guys would be really good at it. I've prided myself for a while on being able to call this, but it'd be a great little game to play on the podcast where you guys get, about 20 different yells from, I'm talking about crowd noise, just the natural crowd noise from different shots. And you play, it's almost like a little trivia game. You play it, people go, oh, that was a 20-foot birdie that burned the edge. Well, that was a 7-iron in the hole, but for a no-name player in the room, too many people watching. That one, it would be great. I actually think that between the three of us, we could do a pretty good job only hearing the crowd reaction and kind of nailing exactly what the shot was.
Oh, yeah.
I like that.
And Pat, you know, Pat's older than me. He's an old guy, and he's been out there a lot of time. He'd be excellent at it. So he'd be really
we could throw out Larry Mize in 87. Yeah. We could get some good ones.
That would be fun.
Yeah, that would be a fun game.
I kind of want to know this, you know, and I'm segueing now and just tangent here, but, you know, we've mentioned Michael Collins a couple times. I think we need some dirt on Michael Collins. Like, what do you got, Sobel? You got any dirt on him?
I mean,
if he was coming on our show, which he has before, he would give dirt on you. So we need you to get him back.
Well, I don't know how much dirt this is, but I'll tell you, this is prototypical Collins, and this isn't just a specific story, but this happens all the time. Well, I think it happened the first time at the Masters maybe 3 years ago. I'd come back to ESPN just prior to the 2015 Masters. I literally started 2 days before Masters week started, and so I drove up to Augusta, and of course I knew Michael really well, and I'd worked with Bob before, and you know, everything kind of gelled pretty quickly. But Tuesday, I think it was, of that week, I said, hey, Michael, you know, we don't have much work to do right now. You want to go take a walk for about an hour and go walk out on the course and go see some stuff? He goes, yeah, man, let's do it. Go. All right. So we walk out there. We walk about 100 yards outside the media center. And some guy turns around and goes, hey, Michael. And Michael looks at me and goes, hey, man, what's going on? You know, nothing, man. Just, you know, just at Augusta National. How great is it? Oh, man, you are having a great time. Oh, look at you. You bought some swag there. Look what you got. Oh, that's really cool. And the guy goes, hey, can I just get a picture with you? Oh, yeah, cool. All right, yeah. Oh, where are you from? Oh, yeah, I'm doing this. Oh, cool. They talk for half an hour. No joke, half an hour. I'm standing there. I'm, you know, there's no phone to check, so I can't sit there and check my phone. I'm like, oh, what is going on? You know, who's he talking? Like his long-lost best friend finally, you know, gives the guy a hug, you know, gives him his phone number, like walks away. I'm like, who is that? He goes, I don't know. What are you talking about? You don't know. I don't know. He said hi to me. So I wanted to be nice. So I said hi. I go, you are way nicer than I could ever be. Someone says hi to me, I give him a little wave and keep going. Maybe nod my head. He will spend half an hour talking to somebody. He is such a good dude. That happens once a week when I'm out on tour with Collins. I will walk out on the golf course with him, and now I just walk away. Now I'm like, I'm not even dealing with you right now. I want to go watch some golf, and Collins will stop and just talk to some guy says, hey, Mike. He's like, hey, what's up? And next thing I know, I mean, he just makes friends everywhere he goes. Me and him played Pinehurst number two the week of Quail, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we're on the third hole. He's already got the caddy's phone number and following him on Instagram, and they're hanging out, and they plan to hang out later that week. And I'm like, dude, how did you even do it that fast? I mean, I can't even remember the guy's name right now, and you've already, like, become best friends with him.
He moves quick. It actually makes me feel worse about our relationship with Michael now, because he's probably doing the same thing to us at the PGA show. We're like, "What up, Collins?" He's like, "Yeah, what up, boys? What's up?" Yeah, he has no idea who we are. Well, you know, I think it's hilarious that Collins does, and probably I'm sure the majority of people watching on ESPN have no idea that he's wearing like basketball shorts below his suit jacket and tie. But ever since I learned that about him, every time I see him on TV, it just makes me laugh. Like, does he do that every single tournament? Did he just wears his basketball shorts because you're only going to see him from like the sternum up?
Oh, we all do it. This is a time honored tradition within the golf.
Oh, is it really?
At least for those of us who are walking the golf course all day. Now, is Brandel Chamblee like suit from the waist up and gym shorts down below? No, but he's on TV. He's a working professional. Those of us who are out grinding away and, you know, following guys on the golf course, we're wearing a golf shirt and shorts all day. And so when it's time to turn the camera on, you throw on a shirt, you throw on a jacket, maybe a tie if you have to. You're not putting pants on. What's the point in that? So we all do it, but somehow Collins has turned it into a cottage industry where everyone knows him as the guy that wears shorts and he's got business up top and party down below, which can mean a whole lot of things we don't want it to mean.
I thought he was the only one. Yeah, he's marketed himself as like the only one who does that.
So, no, he's just a better marketer than the rest of us.
So, all right, well, you know, like, I'm sure you and Michael are pretty close. Like, you guys go to all these tournaments together. Y'all are tag team. Pat and I are pretty close as well. I mean, we've traveled to these golf tournaments together. Like, there's just certain things I know about Pat that a lot of other people don't know. For example, like, when Pat gets inebriated, he gets really angry. Pat is a very non-confrontational, he's a very non-confrontational, easygoing guy. I mean, you know, very non-confrontational. But when he gets inebriated, he flips the switch. You know how people do. Like, So I can tell when Pat gets to that level, he wants to, like, fight people, and he runs his mouth a lot, and it's just a bad situation. I also know that, like, when Pat starts falling asleep, he makes these weird noises, like, he, like, does this murmur thing. You know, and I know that because we've spent enough time together, and we've had to bunk up for a golf tournament together, something like that. So my question is, for Michael Collins, are there some little things about Michael like that, like little quirks about Collins that you could share that a lot of people wouldn't know?
Well, so his Twitter handle is Funny Caddy, because he's, you know, had a career in stand-up comedy, and he's also had a career as a caddy. So Funny Caddy has been his Twitter handle. Among us on the ESPN staff, we call him Sleepy Caddy, because every so often, the alarm will go off for Collins on a given morning, and he will sleep right through it and keep on sleeping. And all of a sudden, he's running to the toilet, he's dripping in sweat, he's, you know, trying to wake himself up. So every once in a while, he's a guy that likes to sleep. I will say, like, he's a gregarious personality. He's a fun guy. I won't say that he won't go out and have a beer with us on occasions. He certainly does, but people always think he's a partier. People always think that, oh, he must get done the course, and he's just raging till 2 a.m. He's partying every night. He's in bed by 9:30 most nights. He needs his sleep. He likes
good.
His beauty sleep.
That's good. Well, you know, actually, since you bring it up, I'll go ahead and expose Pat on this too. But
oh, great.
Here's a really good one. Here's a really good one for you, Sobel. Now you've done plenty of TV, a lot of interviews, radio. You've got your own podcast with Michael. Imagine falling asleep during a podcast when you are the guest, because Pat Perry has done that on a podcast. So a few months back,
do we have to go this route?
Oh yeah. And our listeners love this story, so we can retell it and it's fine. But a few months back, we were guests on another DFS podcast, and they did record late at night, much later than we normally do. I told you Pat's a little bit older; he likes to sleep as well. He'd also had a couple, and so as the evening progressed and the interview progressed, you know, these guys were actually talking about how, like, you know, the Tour Junkies kind of influenced them to get into the DFS podcasting world, and, like, you know, they started listening to us when they started playing DFS. It was like, you know, they were honoring us, they were thanking us for what we've little that we contributed, and they get to Pat and they ask Pat a question, and there's kind of silence. And I'm like, oh, we must have lost Pat. So we move on. We start talking again, and they throw another one to Pat. And they're like, well, maybe he's back on at Pat, and nothing. And then we start talking. In the middle of us talking, we hear. And we're like, what? And everybody's, you know, and I'm like talking about a player, and then we hear, you know, hear it again, and Pat is literally snoring and fell asleep on the podcast. So of course we all lose our minds laughing, and finish the podcast, and then we all hang up, and Pat just sits on the phone until God knows how long, until he woke up and realized he was still on the phone. But yeah, that's Pat likes his sleep too. So him and Michael Collins share that.
I do.
I can honestly say that's never happened to me. I've done a lot of interviews, but I will say that it's really hard when you're doing these things. You're trying to concentrate on just listening and then saying your part. If someone walks up to me, and people walk up, they'll be the golf course. I'm talking on the phone. They'll just think you're talking to somebody on the phone. They'll come up and they'll start talking to you, and I will completely lose concentration, and I will have no idea what the question is. I used to try to play it off and just go, oh, well, yeah, Steve should play well this week. You'd think it'd be good. Now I just go, I got to be honest, I have no idea what you just said. Someone started talking, and I'll just own it. I'll just completely own it now and go, I have no idea. I just got
that's usually best.
I'm going to make this podcast 3 minutes longer because I'm going to leave you with my favorite story. I thought you guys were going to go here.
Please do.
You didn't quite, but I think it encapsulates everything. It gets into golfers, it gets into gambling, it gets into everything we've kind of talked about. It's just good stories. And so anytime I play with somebody, play golf with a new person who finds out what I do, and they say, oh, give me a good story from, you know, life on tour and something about these old famous golfers. Here's my go-to story. It was about 4 years ago, I think, maybe 5 years ago, the Quail Hollow tournament, which at that point, I don't even know what it was, Wells Fargo or whatever
Wells
Fargo, it was at that point, Wachovia, whatever it was. In any case, a few of us go out to walk a few holes with Phil Mickelson during the Pro-Am on Wednesday. And if you're ever in this business and you want to find out a good way to get some good access with players, go to the back nine on the Wednesday Pro-Am, and they are ready to talk to anybody except the Pro-Am partners. And you walk out there, and they'll treat you like you're an old best friend. So we go out there, just walk the last few holes with Phil, and we're walking down the 16th fairway. Phil's got his arm around my shoulder like we're old buddies, and I like to, I love Phil. Phil's one of my favorite guys to interview ever. I have complete respect for Phil. In any case, we're talking. He said, hey, are you guys coming Saturday? And we said, where? What's going on? He said, oh, I've rented out this this little bar restaurant about 2 miles away from the course. It'll just be us. All my treat, drinks, food. There'll be NBA and NHL playoff games on. This is in May. And then there's a Mayweather fight that night. Mayweather Pacquiao, maybe? I couldn't even tell you. But there was a Mayweather fight that night. And he said, we'll have the fight on and just, you know, good times, relaxing, we'll just all hang out. Yeah, sounds good. Thanks for the invite. So, Saturday night, Phil's actually tied for the lead. He's expecting it to rain the whole next day. We go, and it was exactly what he had said. There were maybe 50 or 60 people there, a handful of tour players, some caddies, some other people in the industry. And so, a couple of us kind of sidle up next to Phil at the bar, and he's drinking like one glass of red wine. I mean, he, you know, certainly tied for the lead. He's not, you know, throwing him back or anything like that. But he tells us this whole theory behind, you know, it's going to rain and I'm going to play in a playoff with this guy. I think he was tied with Nick Watney at the time. And none of that happened. And instead, Derek Ernst beat David Lynn in a playoff that year, which even Phil, the great prognosticator, didn't see that one coming. But after the playoff games were over, the undercards are starting for the Mayweather fight. Phil stands up in front of the room. He said, look, I'm not going to make any big speeches, but I just wanted to say to everybody, the staff here is great. If you need any food, you need any drinks, just let them know. They'll take great care of us. Everything's on me. Don't worry about anything else. Don't even have to tip anything. I'll take care of everything. And I just want to say, we'll have the whole fight on. And, oh, by the way, wagering is encouraged. Wager amongst yourself. They were, hey, okay, cool.
Of course, yeah.
The first fight of the night is the light flyweight title fight. No one has any idea who these guys are. No one's wagering. We're just kind of, you know, half watching, half all just kind of hanging out and talking to each other. That fight ends. The second fight of the night is coming up, and Phil stands up again. He said, I'm sorry. I know that I said I wouldn't make any more speeches, but I just want to let everybody know this next fight is the welterweight title fight or whatever it was. He said, we've got the title holder who's 37-0 with 34 knockouts against the challenger who's 17-12. I like the challenger tonight. So, like I said, wagering is encouraged. If anyone would like to wager with me and place a wager, I'll take the challenger tonight. And, of course, everybody in the room goes, you're crazy, Phil. And there's a lot of money being thrown around towards the title holder. And the guy who's 37-0 with 34 knockouts. Everyone goes, you're crazy to take that guy. Well, of course, the fight goes on. Phil's guy knocks him out in the second round. Phil walks around the room, takes money out of everyone's hands. I'm guessing that whatever Phil paid for the restaurant that night,
he paid
probably
for.
Made double in wagers on that fight, and then probably tipped out the staff and the rest of it, broke dead even for the night, and at the end of it, everyone says, wow, thanks, Phil. That was a great night. You really took care of us.
He's winning in life all around. That's awesome.
How good is that? That just encapsulates everything about Phil right there. And if he ever hears that I told that story on the podcast, he'll probably never talk to me again.
Well, we're pretty sure he's not a listener of ours. So
I don't think you have to worry about that one.
Never know.
Yeah, I think you're safe there. And God, like, I hate people like that. Like, I love Phil, but I hate people like that that just get stuff like that right. That is just the guy's got a lot of gifts. That's for sure.
Yes, he does.
That's good, man. That's a good story to go out on. We appreciate the time once again. Jason Sobel, senior golf writer, ESPN.com, at Jason Sobel, ESPN. Hey, man, we'd love to catch up with you again. We hope to see you at maybe a couple tournaments we're trying to make our way to. And if not, you know, maybe next year at the Masters at worst case scenario.
Anytime. Good luck to you guys. Love being on the podcast. Let's maybe try doing it in person next time. That would be really fun.
Yeah, that would be great. Sounds good, Jason. Thanks again for your time, man.
Thanks, Elf.